I was going to say, it seems like everyone's just like messed up right now. Everyone's so tired and just bleh.
I think it's got to be like a Thursday thing, right? We record on Thursdays. Probably, that's a quote from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. First chapter, I believe. The world ends on a Thursday. Arthur Dent is wondering what's going on. Must be Thursday.
I've only ever seen the video, or the movie, rather. I've only ever seen the movie.
The movie's good. But there are more canonical implementations of The Hitchhiker's Guide that are superior. And the movie's maybe top four. There's lots of versions of the material.
I think Thursdays are, especially Thursday at the end of a sprint, it's the worst Thursday. Because you're looking at the board and you're like, how is this all going to get done? It's all in review. How are we going to review all these MRs? Trying to figure out which ones you can blast through and which ones you can't.
MRs go brrrr.
Mm-hmm.
You sent me a funny message earlier. You said, I'm over here making a really detailed feature breakdown that I could probably build 2/3 of this thing in the time it's taking me to chop it up into actionable steps with context for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was great. I mean, obviously, that depends on the size of the feature you're doing, right? I mean, at some point, there's an optimization problem here where the complexity of the feature is so low and the time to chop it up is so high that they cross, right? I feel like you're approaching that for some things.
Well, yeah. So this one specifically, too, I guess I can just say what the feature is. So it's like notification preferences for this app's users. It just so happens that it's actually really flexible. So let me throw down some terms here really quick. So the terminology here is a channel. You have a notification channel. And so a channel is like Slack, email, SMS, PagerDuty, whatever, right? The thing that's actually doing the sending. And then you have channel instances. So a channel instance is a configured channel for a user. So if you're a user, Rockwell, and you look at all the channels and you say, I want Slack to be able to send to this channel, and you might use a webhook. When you actually like configure that, it's called a channel instance. That's what they call it.
Okay.
Then you have like notifications, and each notification has an area. So a notification might be like anomalous logins exceeded. Someone's trying to brute force a login or something like that, right? So that's a notification, and it has an area like network. So you have these moving pieces, and how it works is that every channel can have basically per user like unlimited channel instances. So you can say, I want to be able to send to 10 different Slack webhook URLs. I want to be able to send to 10 different emails. And then you can basically have any combination of those being sent to you by a notification. So for any notification, you can say, I want these three Slacks, these two emails, and this SMS. And for this one over here,
it's join tables all the way down.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's join tables all over. So what I'm doing is I had to like figure out their API, because we had a design. They did not build an API that reflected the design. They built the API for like endgame, which is fine.
Oh, all right. A little over-engineered.
Mm-hmm. So now I get to look at what the designs we have, work with the designer to build the designs that will match what we need, and then chop it up enough and document enough so that way two different developers can go implement it in tandem. That's the real challenge. So friend of the show, Brian, was asking me, like, so what is it that you do exactly? So like if someone were
what
to...
What would you say you do here?
Yeah, so someone were to ask me, like, what exactly do I do? I would say most of what I do is I try to figure out how two developers can work on the same feature at the same time.
you're a glorified task scheduler, or what's the thing called in the Beam? I think it's called the scheduler, right?
The scheduler, yeah.
The scheduler.
So that's what I'm doing. Like, I could build this. It's join tables all the way down, yes, but it's not like we need any sort of like complicated application state like Redux or anything. It's all server state. So we it's all like an API request away to build the thing. It's not like we have to maintain a bunch of states. So that makes it a lot easier. But
designing those many-to-many forms is, I don't know. If you're using React, it's not as bad as just using the plain old web, you know, and just static HTML with a little bit of JS sprinkled in. You know, like the old Rails way of managing that is, I've been doing a lot of that lately, and it's not fun. You have to, like, am I going to do checkboxes? Am I going to do, like, a multi-select drop-down? You know, there's lots of terrible ways to do it. And I feel like in React, it makes that kind of thing a lot easier, but it's still not fun, because then you got to deal with the updates and wiping out old records, and yeah, it's this whole thing. And when you were describing this whole notification flow, I'll put a link in the show notes. There was this photo or a flowchart that Slack posted a few years back. I'm sure it's even more complicated now, but it shows their decision tree for when to send a notification to someone. And it's based off of like which devices are most recently active, what their preferences are, server settings, user settings, channel settings, you know, all this complicated logic. And what's great about it is like even then, it's Slack notifications are still bad. Like I still get them when I don't want to, and vice versa, right? Sometimes I don't get them when I want to see them. So it is a complicated problem.
It's a very complicated problem. Luckily, I'm not on the server side or the back end team for this project, so I don't have to worry about it. I just have to build the UI for it, which helps me a lot. But
and you just throw the request over the fence.
We'll circle back to the join table thing in a second here, because I have some notes on that. But yeah, so I'm having to document it enough that they can kind of work on it, so I can be like, all right, you work on, I don't know, implementing the React query hooks, you work on scaffolding out the table for now with dummy data. And then there's another, there's like extra work that happens because of it has to be done in parallel. So like, okay, you work on the table, but you work with dummy data now, and then we'll make another task later to remove the dummy data. But if you didn't have to do it in parallel, you wouldn't have to do that in the first place. So yeah, part of like, it's kind of like figuring out how much can we prop up in the name of parallelism, that makes it work. And then you always end up with these tasks, like you do this view, you do this view, you do this view. And those are all like story pointed as like one, right? Like pretty simple. And then there's always a story point four task of like put it together.
The integration piece. Yeah.
Always. Yeah.
So it's like the school group project, right? Like, you can't just have one guy doing all the work.
That's right.
It's funny because I was thinking about, as you're describing this, like, what about extreme programming or pair programming, right? Where you have, you know, someone ostensibly at the keyboard and someone just kind of breathing down their neck over their shoulder, which I know is a popular way to do things in some circles. But like, that's the opposite of what you're describing. It's the inverse, right? You're trying to get it done twice as fast, whereas technically pair program using twice as many humans, right, man hours to do it in, you know, use 2 man hours for 1 hour of work, which is the opposite. But you know, maybe that you'd use that for the integration piece, like you said, but when you get to that, but it doesn't really solve the problem up to that point.
I guess the main selling point for extreme repair programming is that eventually the 2x time spent up front is paid off in less bugs, less hacks having to be implemented, less whatever down the road. Yeah, it'd be hard to sell that to the client over on our side. Be like, how about you pay us twice as much?
Yeah.
And, you know, so yeah, it's a lot of it is like managing, like how much of the can do we kick down the road for when their team inherits it? I want to be a good steward and a good contractor and not kick cans down the road to them, but also we have to deliver the thing.
You got to kick a barrel down the road instead.
Mm-hmm.
So you described earlier, we're talking about how the API was sort of overloaded. Are you just basically ignoring? Are you just leaving nulls everywhere? Are you just not implementing stuff? Well, I mean, I guess if you're just doing the front end, you just ignore it, right?
Yeah, you just ignore it. You can ignore it. You can
gotcha.
Scaffold it. We use Mirage a little bit here and there to like in branches. We'll just pull a Mirage in and make a very light. We could use like, we could grab the JSON response from the API and then use that as a fixture in Mirage, so we don't have to like scaffold the models. But that way, because we're using Fetch anyway, so that way you can like actually work with real network requests on that side, which is easy enough to like put in a branch and tear out of the branch before merging. It's not too, you know, intensive that it causes issues to do that. But that's been my approach. So like I have to do a demo on Monday, and the demo involves like, you know, showing what empty states look like or like new states look like in our account data for the staging API doesn't have those. So I can just make a branch, pull Mirage into it, use some JSON for the demo because the important people go to that. So it's probably worth a couple hours to set all that up and demo it thoroughly without being like, all right, let me comment this code out and let it recompile on the fly. And, you know,
is that just for demo purposes or does that have value to the people, you know, who you're dishing the work out to as well?
Just for demo purposes. But sometimes they take that and they try to use it. They, in some cases, they've used it to get more funding. So
okay.
It's important in that aspect too, because they can take it to people they're pitching to, investors are pitching to, and be like, here's what we're working on right now. Here's what we've got in progress. So they don't have to, you know, just sell what they have live, I guess. It's selling the future, really.
Mm.
So, yeah, it has, you know, I've done, like, they've requested demos before and I've done them. And they, like, I know for a fact they use that to turn around and go get funding. So it's good that I can be helpful that way too, because then they just give us more money. Hopefully, I mean, that's the idea, right? Later. So
it goes right in your pocket, right? That's how that works. You get a cut.
Yeah. So, luckily, like, this could all just be React Query, I think. React Query manages the caches and all that stuff, so it should be relatively straightforward. My deliverable, I think, for Monday for the team is to have this document of terminology, a list of new components that we'll need. Like, I kind of pseudo-name them, and then I map those to the API endpoints that they will need to hit. And I think that's enough to get people going.
Yeah, seriously, as a developer, if someone just handed me that, the weight of those making those decisions or making the wrong decisions there, having, you know, that responsibility being removed from me,
yeah,
would be such a great, great thing.
Yeah. So, but I wanted to circle back and talk about join tables.
Let's do it.
Or the lack thereof. So,
oh no, don't get, let's not get some MongoDB nonsense.
No Mongo. Yeah. No Mongo, but
or document stores.
So, like I've been saying, I've been working with my buddy Nabil on this little side project. So people in the chat are also chiming in. No Mongo. So it's just a small project, small website, nothing major. And so the front end we're using Next because we both wanted to explore that more. And the back end I was just using Express and Postgres. But Next has these the chat is still going off. Mongo no or Mong Mong no. Yeah, Mong no. Yes, Next. We wanted to use Next. And so Next has this neat feature called API routes. And I believe Nuxt has something similar too. But I was thinking to myself, like, why couldn't we merge the two? So we could do a monorepo, right? So we could keep everything together. That's always a pain to set that up. But I was looking at Next API routes and I was wondering about, instead of doing like a monorepo or something similar, could we just use the API routes to be the API and be the backend?
What?
So here's how it works conceptually. Both Next and Nuxt are page-based routing, right? So they're not like, you don't set up an object or you don't have any sort of like, you know, XML structured tree for routing. It's based off of the file structure. So with Next, if you have your pages directory and then you put an API directory in it, the files in the API directory become API endpoints. So then you could make a request to /API/. Okay. So in our instance, we have API/stories/index.ts. Okay. And so what that does is it maps to an API endpoint of /API/stories. And so when you make a request to /API, Next knows that you're making an API request and you can handle that API request by, you know, doing whatever you need and returning JSON.
Okay, so this is not a proxying situation. This is actually running on the Next, you know, what ostensibly should have been a server-side rendered, you know, request. It's actually doing logic there.
Yeah, let me just drop the docs here in the stream chat.
Well, basically, it's just returning a VIEW view, right? Except instead of returning HTML, it's just returning JSON. Is that right? More or less? just like in Rails, how you can render, you know, on a controller, you can render JSON or HTML.
Yeah. It's just, so there's more to it. So it follows the connect pattern. So you can actually use like some Express middlewares and things. You could even like override it altogether and have Express running completely. But the idea is that instead of having to build a separate, build and maintain a separate API for our app, it's small enough, we can just implement controllers basically on a route by route basis. And in our case, these API routes are just communicating to Firebase.
So why wouldn't you do this?
Why wouldn't you do it? Well, that's why okay. I stopped making the Express one. I was like, I don't want to, you know, this is dumb. I don't want to do a monorepo. We could just use the API route. So we just started using that. And then I was like, okay, well, I could just set up a managed DB instance on DigitalOcean and then just connect to it via that. So like when an API route runs, it would just connect to the connection pool, do the thing via whatever library I'm using. And then we just return JSON, right? So just a regular controller. It's just your DB is somewhere else. But then you still kind of have to have some way of like migrating that database, managing, you know, versions and whatever else, like the typical database stuff. So at that point, a friend of the show, Greg, he's been working on a book, kind of a book club app or like a book reading list app. And he was using Firebase. So I was like, I'll give it a shot. I've never really used it. I don't know if I'll love it. I don't know if I'll hate it, but I'll give it a try. And so that's where we'll get into the join table things, right? Because Firestore is a document storage model. It's not like it's like Mongo or any other document store.
Oh, so this is Mongo. See, you're just holding out on me.
No,
man.
It's not Mongo. It's Firestore. It's a document storage. So basically how the app was working right now is that we have a few API routes. And so the front end just makes a fetch request. We're not importing the Firebase SDK directly or anything like that. So it makes an API request to /API/stories. The API route runs, it uses the Firebase SDK, gets the data, and just returns JSON.
Because you can use Firebase directly from clients. It's kind of designed to be used that way, right? From mobile clients and such, right?
Yeah, but it's
you wanted to.
It's a pretty heavy payload. It's like 200K. Before gzipping, so it's pretty. Yeah, the chat's now saying Mongo adjacent. I'll give you that. I won't admit to using Mongo, but I'm Mongo adjacent now. So yeah. So the other reason for not using Firebase's SDK in the components is that I could swap them out as long as the JSON coming back matches. I could just swap out Firebase for Postgres, right? Our Lord and Savior Postgres. I could do that pretty easily. It just happens in the API layer. It's been pretty great, to be honest, so far. It just works. It was very easy to set up. We have one repo. It's nice. Like, we're not doing anything wildly crazy, like wildly complicated. So, like you said before, like, why wouldn't you do this?
Congratulations, Sean. You just reinvented Rails, but with more steps.
Is it really more steps?
I mean, you know, transpiling JavaScript, server-side rendering, like all this stuff, like all the steps are brushed under the rug.
Yeah, they're definitely brushed under the rug. Yeah,
you're just going back to the Rails mono repo architecture, which, you know what, it works fine.
Not necessarily though, because the API routes can call to any service, and it's
You can. That's normal. I mean, but.
It is Rails style because the front end and back end are living in the same place, but it's I don't know. It feels very different from when I was doing Rails.
Listen, this is not meant as a criticism.
Sure.
This is a rousing endorsement of this approach. I think it's cool. Does Nuxt have anything similar at all?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they have API routes as well. In fact, I'm positive they do as well. But yeah, it's been really nice for like a side project because everything's just there. The API is very small. And we can both dig into what we wanted to learn anyway, which was Next and like more React and TypeScript usage. So
that's really cool. That's cool. I like it.
Yeah. So the lack of joins was interesting because I was like, all right, I'll give it a try. I don't love the idea that it's document storage, but again, what we're doing is very, very simple. So I have a subscription to the O'Reilly book thing, which we can talk about more in a minute too. But I found I found, so I have a book called SQL Queries for Mere Mortals and Database Design for Mere Mortals. And so there's also an accompanying document databases, or it's, I can't remember what it is, but it's basically like, you know, document databases for Mere Mortals. And so it just goes through like a, here's what this thing is. Generally do this, generally don't do that. That's kind of like what the book is in a nutshell.
One of the things I keep seeing people use Firebase for is sort of real-time or soft real-time, you know, WebSocket streaming of things. Because I know that works pretty well out of the box. Do you have any plans for that? Are you going to do anything with that? Was that going to work with your API endpoint thing or what?
Yeah, totally could.
I know you've been looking for an excuse to do WebSocket stuff. This might be a good opportunity.
Yeah, we could do that. Like, you know, voting or commenting or whatever, you know, as like interactive stuff can be real time. But
yeah, yeah, just as simple as like, yeah, like you said, just updating vote counts just to prevent polling, right?
Yeah. So, and everyone in the chat's going to, they're going to put an F in the chat. But so I started reading this, I guess it's called NoSQL for Mere Mortals. And it starts off by like explaining what it is, the differences between, you know, SQL and NoSQL, and like the benefits and trade-offs of SQL and NoSQL. And of course, the first thing it talks about is normalization and denormalization, right?
Yeah, indexes, man.
Yeah, indexes. And so basically, like if anyone's not familiar, like normalizing would mean that like you reduce data duplication in your database, because normalization is the root of all data anomalies, is like the law that people kind of like say. The more duplicated data you have, the more anomalies you'll end up running into with your data, which is true. It's fair. And a canonical example for this is like orders and addresses, right? So if you have an orders table and the same person has three orders and each order stores an address in the order, which one is their current address? Was it the last one? Was the last address the gift address? Like there's, you know, there's no way to like manage them separately. So to normalize things, you'd pull the addresses to a different table and you'd relate them via join tables, you know, foreign key relations, whatever. And so of course it takes that to an extreme and it starts talking about, okay, building receipts. And I have firsthand experience because I built an e-commerce system from scratch with like orders and line items and order addresses and customer addresses and billing addresses and like order pricing and caching and, promotional, coupons and like all that stuff. So basically it just builds this giant web of interconnected relationships. And it's like joins all the way down, right? And so they're like, well, with NoSQL, you tend to prefer like a little bit of data duplication is okay. And you try to design your schema, even though you don't have a real schema with NoSQL, you try to design it in the way that you minimize like joins or API requests, I guess, to build a view. And so, of course, then you can't rely on referential integrity. You can't rely on the database to do this stuff for you. But the known trade-off, like you're accepting this trade-off of accepting a document database, and that you're doing this in the software. It's now your responsibility as a programmer. It's the software's responsibility to enforce referential integrity and however you want to design your system. So it's cool that the book was like, this is an acknowledgement that you make and something you accept. And I think one of my main problems with document DBs before was that they're pushed on people, especially beginners, and the beginners don't know what they're accepting and they're trying to start side projects or learn. And they're just using a document store because it's easy to get going. There's less rules, right?
So two quick anecdotes related to that. I think I mentioned this on the show before, but for fun, I tried to develop a Minecraft server plugin with a friend of mine. And those are all written in Java. And, you know, we were just working on it just because the guy managed a server and we just wanted to try stuff. And we're like, let's try Mongo, you know, to see what it's like, right, for maintaining the state of this server plugin, right? Like just something simple as like keeping track of money in a wallet, right? Like you have so much gold or whatever. And yeah, how quickly we just ended up making indexes for everything, right? And trying to maintain that referential integrity in code. You're just so used to thinking that way. And so that was definitely a learning experience. We didn't get too far with that plugin thing. I don't think MongoDB was the fault of that. It was just, you know, we just ran out of steam. It was just for fun anyways. But like, I just quickly fell right into that. Like, you know, for something like you know, imagine account balance, right? Like that's something you definitely want normalized. You don't want to try to look up someone's account balance and get three different numbers back. It doesn't make any sense. So that's literally the extent of my experience with a document store. I mean, besides using, you know, JSON columns and for small little payloads and stuff in Postgres. But the other thing was I ran into the same thing with Redis. You know, I there was an in-between time where remote ham radio's sort of core servers for the WebSocket stuff ran on pure Ruby, and I wanted to be able to scale those horizontally, so I had to store the state somewhere, and that state ended up in Redis. And Redis is great. I love Redis. But I ended up having the same issue where, like, I needed to store information and pull it out and do it in such a way where I could, there were indexes, there were references between chunks of data stored in Redis. And, like, again, that's kind of my fault for not, I don't know, just understanding, like, what Redis is for and how to use it effectively, you know? But, like, I ended up trying to make a whole, I think I just ended up deleting the code because I never used it. I made my whole, basically, my own Redis ORM with like IDs and indexes, and it would keep things up to date, and it would do this whole thing just with Ruby classes. It was a mess, dude.
Yeah, I think I think I'm saying the name right, Johnny or Johnny S in the chat is saying like their company's using it, and it can't. It's like a nightmare, and I think it can be very useful in definitely situations, but I think a lot of times what I've seen is people tend to approach NoSQL with SQL in mind, and they try to bend NoSQL to match what they're familiar with SQL, and that's going to be a bad time.
It basically sums up experience.
Yeah, it's going to be a bad time. So it was really interesting reading the book and just like saying, like just seeing how they approach things, and reading Firestore's documentation to see how they approach things. And it's been fine to work with so far. Like I'm not doing anything too crazy. I guess the funniest example that you'll probably really rise at is, one of the simplest things you can do with regular SQL databases is a counter cache columns, right? You don't want to have to do a join in a account every time. If you're doing a relationship, you just calculate it, store it, cache the account on a column, right? So it's like, okay, well, we have votes for these stories that people can share. Obviously, I don't want to always sum the stories for the votes for a story, so counter cache it is. And I was like, okay, how do you do counter cache with Firestore? And they have an article specifically about this. And it turns out that for technical reasons, like when you're updating a document, it's very CPU. It can be very CPU intensive and also IO bound, because like if you have a document that keeps growing, like say you have a story document and a votes array, if the votes array keeps growing, then on disk it'll have to be moved around. Because the storage engine is going to want to keep it together. And so it could be like, you know, probably imperceivable to humans, but CPU heavy to like be updating this array all the time. If the CPU is like, oh, where's this stupid thing going to fit on the disk? Right. So anyway, like I learned about that with Elasticsearch too. Like you want to write in bulk because it's CPU expensive to update these documents, because generally, even if you update one thing, you have to write the whole document back to disk. So I was like, okay, well, so I'm looking in how to you know implement this counter cache, and then Firestore actually has a limitation. You can't update the same document more than once per second.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So then I was like, okay, well, I don't have that problem now. Obviously, I don't have users, and so I don't have people upvoting stories more than like the same story more than once per second. But thinking down the road, like it just was interesting to me. I wanted to learn, like, okay, how would you deal with this? Well, their answer was sharded counter cache columns. So you'd have like a different collection, and you'd have multiple like vote counts that all map to the same story. And so that way, when someone clicks upvote, it randomly picks one of the shards, ticks the count. And then when you're getting the count for your story, you would just sum the shards that belong to that story.
Yeah, I hate that. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, at some point that's not, you have to combine that technique with the bulk updates, like you said, for Elasticsearch, right? You have to store a bunch of, you imagine your web server, right? You got 1,000 people clicking upvote and downvote. You gotta store all those things in bulk and update them with a throttled request. Mm-hmm. It's the only way.
Yeah. So I just thought that was really interesting. I was like, oh, that wouldn't have dawned on me to do that, but I guess it works. They have very specific, I guess it was something that was coming up a lot. So they're like, here's exactly how you do this.
Well, that's, I mean, that's a service limitation, right? They're doing that to protect their own, so you don't abuse, you know, API limits or whatever. But it also is kind of a pre-optimization that might help you out in the long run. Like you said, updating these big documents is going to be a pain in the butt. By getting you to shard them out sooner and work with more atomic units of data, it's going to be easier on everyone, including you.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. So, like I said, it's been fine so far. Kevin Sukulb in the chat says, like, this all sounds a lot of work to avoid a relational database. No, well, yes, and I guess yes and no. Like, I'm not avoiding relational. It's just that this is convenient. So that's the only reason.
You know what you should just do, Sean? You should go over to your Azure account.
Oh God!
Fire up one of those 24 terabyte memory instances and just store your entire database in memory. And we don't even have to touch the disk.
I mean, that could work. Until an intern trips over the wrong cord. Until Thomas is like screwing around in the server room and trips over the wrong cord, right? And unplugs it.
24 terabytes of RAM, Sean.
Wait, Thomas, why did you unplug my server?
He's saving you money by doing that. Imagine how much that costs per hour.
24 terabytes. I was just reading a story on Hacker News how this company was like testing something with Firestore and Cloud Run, I think it was called. And they ran up like a $75,000 bill on accident.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Crazy. But yeah, so I don't love it. I don't like hate it, but I think maybe what's helping me just be whatever about it is that like just reading about the concessions you make and the upfront, like here's what you will have to deal with, you know, having those upfront and like just knowing them, like, okay, well, that makes sense. You know, you kind of like go into it informed.
Yeah. You have to know when you don't care, like, when not to care about referential integrity. Like, is it going to be good enough? Is it even relevant to the type of data you're storing? You know, I feel like maybe 90% of use cases, probably you want to just use this plain old relational database because of all the guarantees it offers. And, you know, Postgres is amazing and you can scale it up to the scale that your application could possibly need, you know, vertically, right? You can always resize it and make it bigger, read-only replicas. And, you know, like that you can get so far with that, you know, you have MongoDB's web scale or whatever, but so is Postgres, man. Anyway, I gotta get on my soapbox here. This doesn't have to be a Postgres bashing party, but I think I do think it is really interesting.
Yeah, like this thing's not a business I'm trying to start. It's a fun project for learning, and it could be cool if people use it, but it's not like I'm not worried about it. So it's really cool to be like, all right, well, that's all done. What do I do now? I build the UI. Okay, let's do that. It was crazy how easy it was. So we'll see how. I'm sure I'll complain sooner or later about Firestore and all that. But you know, I'm wrapping everything in those API layers. So if we do have to change stuff again, it'll just be swapping out calls in the controller instead. I could even just make a lib folder and like wrap it in a service layer too.
So putting React and versus Vue aside, how does Next compare to Nuxt from the tooling perspective?
The tooling perspective, it's fine. It's good.
About the same.
Yeah. I find Nuxt documentation a little bit more approachable. Next docs are a little bit thin sometimes, like especially around API layers and like middlewares. But it, yeah, Next is good. What's really cool is that I think Nuxt has this now too, but you can basically use like its static props. And so interchangeably with like get server side props or get initial props. So like server side props are things that happen on the server before it goes to the client. I think initial props are things that happen on the client side, and server side props or get static props are things that are statically generated. So you can have an app where if like a lot of your content maybe like come from a CMS and doesn't change often, you can actually statically render all that stuff and still have the server side render app run like right, like side by side with it. You don't have to split that out at all. So it's like you can build almost like anything you want just with Next, which is pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. And when you say static, are you saying like it's cached on the Express server somewhere or?
No, it's like static. It's like compiled to static files.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Mm.
That's cool. I mean, that like for using the example of our website for the show, right? DNC.show, like we had an issue where we kept hitting simple cast API and we would hit their API limits. So we had to throttle the crap out of it just so we could regenerate the site every week. Like, you could just cache those JSON responses on disk, right? There you go.
Yeah. With Next, you could actually just generate the static site. And then if you wanted to have more interactive bits, you could still have that. I mean, like with Next as well.
I see what you're saying.
Because
okay,
the cool. app boots up and it still runs client side. It's just that there's no, like, the rendering is done at build time, because server side rendering, the rendering is done at request by the server, and then client side, the rendering is done on the client, right? So with the static option, it's actually built at build time. And then the React app boots up when things come out. So
I just had a thought with Nux, with my personal website, I was using that, what was that file based CMS thing?
Nuxt content.
I think it was Nuxt content. Yeah. Wonder if you can use Nuxt content, but instead of pulling down files, it's actually just a function call. It says a fetch and returns.
Probably.
Returns JSON. That's probably a thing, right?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about the... Yeah, they're incredibly complicated tools, and layers are abstracted away from you, but it's really compelling, and especially like e-commerce, for example, like thinking about DK. Like, DK is totally server-side rendered, but there's like thousands and thousands of pages, and so... When robots hit the site, they hit it pretty hard. Like Google Shopping hits it, Bing hits it, like all these random robots hit it and crawl the site. Like these random, I don't know, like IBM's Watson or whatever it was, like slammed the site one time. and so it's really interesting. Like, you can go and look at bigger websites like Wayfair, for example. It seems like a lot of the actual product pages are like built. They're static pages that were built by something. And so I was like, how could we even do that? Because it seems like it would always be building, right? Like, our clients are in there uploading or updating their products, or we're updating products based off of like sales starting or ending. It seems like something would always be in some various state of building. So how would we even do that? Like, if thinking about Netlify, like, would it even build 40,000 pages? Maybe, I don't know. But
they will if you throw enough money at them and get enough server minutes.
Right. But it's interesting, like the idea of maybe you could statically render the most popular products. Somehow you could figure that out, or statically render the first X number of product pages, because people probably aren't going to page through 20 pages. Are they going to page through 10 pages before they search again? You know, are they, you know, so you could probably statically render out a certain subset of your pages. And so then, think of the load that would save on a server, especially around Black Friday or like heavy traffic seasons for shopping.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you're just basically caching at that point, right? You're just caching it to disk.
Yeah. So it's like what the Jamstack, right? So Jamstack e-commerce is a really big thing that's happening right now. People are talking about, but it's pretty compelling to think about that, like how the different approaches you could use. And then you could use Nuxt or Next API routes for card endpoints, checkout endpoints, and it's all kind of like an integrated application. And then you can reach out to whatever microservices or services you need on the other side for processing. So
that is cool to think about. I know I was making the joke before about keeping your database in memory, but I remember, and I don't know if this is still the case, but years ago I was reading the engineering blog from Reddit, right? And they relied heavily on Memcache to basically keep the site running. You know, like, they just had huge instances with huge amounts of RAM, and any story, vote, comment, everything was just basically in Memcache at all times. Mm-hmm. And they very infrequently actually hit the disk for, you know, persisting stuff to the database. I don't remember what they're using for the database underneath, but the just doing everything in memory. You know, maybe they're not caching to that level of, you know, generating static pages necessarily, but like, it's all there. And it just becomes a cache invalidation problem at that point. Just, you know, chucking stuff out of memory when no one's looking at it.
So that was actually a big part of a lot of my job interviews before I went to MetaLab was specifically that. I remember specifically the VP of engineering at Kong. We had our call, and he threw some situations at me, and he was specifically like looking for how I might approach caching something, or how I might approach dealing with something that would require cache. And he specifically was calling out, like, you know, back in the old days, we just throw everything in Memcache and keep moving.
Is that not a thing anymore? Is that the old days? Is that not how we do it?
Well, because he doesn't code anymore, really. So to him, he's like, this is what we used to do. So I'm sure he's, you know, well aware of what's happening, but he was kind of basically approaching it like, this is what I used to do when I was in your position.
You know what else you could do, Sean? Just use Phoenix and you wouldn't have to cache anything because it's so fast.
Yeah.
Problem solved.
You could.
The main appeal of the next thing is, to me, the more I think about it is, web applications are more complicated now than they've ever been. You might have some statically generated or server-side generated things. You might have some statically generated things. You might have some dynamically generated things. You might have an API, right? And like all those pieces are fundamentally different and also are different for different use cases. You know, we've kind of talked about that this whole episode is like what particular type of throwing pixels at the user's eyes, like how do you get at that point?
Yeah.
It depends on the use case, right? And traditionally you might have to rope in five different things to do that, you know, like for RHR, I've got a Nux console, I've got a Rails backend, I'm doing WebSockets with Phoenix, right? Mm-hmm. So the appeal of having everything basically under this big JavaScript umbrella, you know, I mentioned before, like I don't want to pull modern JavaScript into my Rails application. I just don't. Like, it's just going to be a nightmare. I don't want to use Webpacker. I don't use Webpack at all in there. Mm-hmm. I'm just using plain old vanilla JS in there just because I don't want the deployment headaches of trying to integrate those things. It's just not worth it for me. But having all that stuff sort of accessible, quote unquote, for free under that same, you know, monorepo, having static, having, you know, a dynamic thing, having SSR and having APIs, like that's what more do you need? Maybe throw WebSockets in there, like, you know what I mean? And you've got a fully fledged server application. I think that's the most appealing part to me is just knowing that you have that tool set to just hit the ground running with whatever, you know, you can migrate whatever parts of that application need optimizing or additional features for those particular use cases. Mm-hmm. So that is, I don't know. If I were to listen to myself 2 years ago, I'd probably be like hitting myself over the head right now because I still think SSR JavaScript is weird and gross to me, but like it does work. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely limbo land. And there's you have to deal with a lot when, like, take authentication, for example. I've been thinking about how I want to handle authentication. Do I just want to use JWT? Do I want to use a cookie because it's the same domain? I can do whatever I want, but it has to work on the server side and the client side. It has to work on both sides of it. And I think that was one of the strangest things to get used to when I started using Nuxt was, where did my console log go? Oh, it's in my terminal because this happened on the server, not the client. Or vice versa, right? Yeah. So,
but like conversely, like I've been working on Roadham Radio and this billing stuff. And for example, I was working on the signup flow this week. And I was demoing it, and I was like, oh, yeah, here's where you put in your password for your new account. And he's like, you know, can we make it so that when the user types in, we can show them, you know, the strength of their password, you know, as they're typing, you know, minimum requirements, require these characters and whatever, like every website has. And I'm just like, no, that's out of scope for this. I'm not pulling in JavaScript to do that. I'm not pulling in some weird jQuery plugin. I don't want to build a custom view or React component for that. Like, it's just going to be plain old click submit and pray that the server validation comes back without some red text on your form.
Right.
Like, that's it. But I had to make the decision because of the time constraints that I'm in, but also because the technology just didn't allow me to just go in and just do that quickly, you know, because I knew all the overhead associated with that and I just have to skip it for now. You know, I want to do that. I should do that. It's obviously the better experience. Like, there's no question about that, but it's just like, not going to happen right now.
Sure.
And I, you know, I wouldn't be able, ow, straight up bit me.
Bucky get ya?
Yeah. It's just, you know, there's just nothing I can do about that right now.
Yeah, totally.
And that's frustrating as a developer. You know, I want to provide a great experience and interface, but I just, my hands are tied by my own tools.
But yeah, so I don't know. I've been thinking about a lot of stuff like that. And then it's, you know, getting more exposure to different types of projects and different types of clients at MetaLab and trying to think about how could we, like, you know, if they come in and time is of the essence and budget is of the essence, like, and they're like, well, we can't reach this amount, but this is our magic number. If we can hit this amount, we can sign the deal, you know? So I've been on several been in several situations where I'm working with, I've actually did an estimation project with Paul, where Paul and I got together and estimated a project out. Soup to nuts, like, what is this going to cost and how long is it going to take?
That's cool.
And so we're constantly looking, or I'm constantly looking around for things like Next, where maybe we don't need all of it, but if you can actually build an MVP without having to loop in a full-on separate Rails API or a full-on, like, lock the client into that, right? Not that lock-in's a bad thing, because if they're choosing Rails, they're going to want to choose Rails or similar. But if there's something that we can use to stand up that we can use to connect to services like a Postgres database, then they can connect whatever they want to that later, right? So it's kind of putting them in a position, a client in a position, especially early stage startups in a position to pivot if they need to change technologies without like a significant like lock-in up front. And of course, there's trade-offs for that, right? Like sometimes you just want the security of a Rails. It's been done before. Like you're not doing anything new with Rails. No one's doing anything new with Rails, except for maybe, hey, email or whatever. But that's what I'm trying to do is like, are there things we can adopt like Next that will shave days, weeks, or months off of a project, because that would just allows us to sign more work.
Really, what it comes down to is it sounds like you're trying to get away from the sort of custom React app that you keep describing for every new project. There, I mean, is that true?
But it's even bigger than that, though. It's like, get away from the custom API, custom client for everything new.
Got it.
So take serverless functions, for example, right? That's a hot buzzword, right? But realistically, like you could build a real app, like a real business off of Netlify and Netlify functions and be in a position where you could, oh shoot, we need performance. So like real performance. So let's go with Go. Or, oh, we actually need, like, we need to be able to, you know, tap into the ecosystem of Rails or Laravel. So let's do that. Right. So really it's more about, I guess, like once you make that decision, it's very hard to change. Right. So I've been in a position where it was a little bit easier because it was me and I knew the code base and I could rewrite it. But for larger companies or even medium sized companies, it's like real hard. It's really hard to do a rewrite, right? It's expensive to do a rewrite. So instead of locking in up front to an ecosystem and us being like, you know, hope you love it, do more things like, well, of course, it's going to live in a database at some point. So if we can use a cloud function to put data there and it's going to work for a while and you can scale it horizontally as much as you want, and you're only paying for when the function is running, maybe that's a better approach up front for them to figure out what actually is really going on. Because we mostly deal in UIs and interfaces. So if we can get them a really killer UI and do it in a way that they can grow, right? They can get new users and they can learn what their users want without locking them into a very specific tech decision, I think that could be beneficial to them. Because at the end of the day, if it's just in Postgres, then they can hook whatever they want to Postgres. You know, they can spin up one-off services if they need to do something specific. But functions are really, really interesting. It kind of a little bit, I don't know. That's mainly like why I started going that route. I started looking into functions, but then I was like, all right, let's come back one step farther to what I'm used to and use Next API routes, because that's a little bit closer to an API, right? Because you have these controller routes, whereas functions are like individual, isolated, kind of like autonomous, like a function doesn't know about another function. They're just there. They run and they tear down. Right.
Wait. So hold on. What you're saying is it's just functions.
Yeah.
Got it.
It's just functions and spreadsheets. You know, just shoot that data into Google Sheets from a cloud function, and you're good to go. No one would even know or care.
Just rocket it into Google Sheets.
In fact, then you would not ever have to build a stupid reporting like data table ever again. It's just Excel or it's just Google Sheets. Just export the chart.
We're gonna make a new stack. We need to workshop an acronym for it.
But it's all, I don't know, it's all real strange. It's a strange world thinking about functions, because I think when you think about the traditional monolith model of, it's like security. You can do it. You can scale it. You can build it. Right. It's all been done before.
Oh, you're talking about security, not from a OPSEC perspective, but from
someone out there has an answer and you can pay them to give it to you. Whereas with functions, like someone probably has an answer and you can probably pay them more to give it to you. But yeah, so I don't know. That's the kind of stuff I've been thinking of, is like not like building apps without having I'm not even talking microservices. I'm talking like, if you know it's going to end up in a database, how creative can you get with getting data into it without locking in too much? Because if you really, really think about it, if you're building an app with like Rails, are you sending your own emails? Probably not. You're probably just using a third-party provider. Your database is probably yours, but you own it, but it's probably on DigitalOcean, Heroku, or AWS, or some variant, right? It's probably not on a box that you're controlling. Like you probably didn't spin up a DO instance, throw PG on it, and you're probably not running your production servers off that. You're probably using something managed.
Make a lot of assumptions, but okay.
Not a lot of hand waving there, of course, but in the last year, like, I don't know, I feel like the majority of people are probably using some sort of managed solution for a DB. There's plenty of cases where it's not happening, but I can't see myself ever doing that personally, but I'm not a DBA either. So what other things, like notification sending? Yeah, you might just run some jobs in your database, but a lot of people actually just use Mailgun or some other thing. So again, that's another third party that you're using. So basically a lot of especially early companies, I think these MVPs, their monolith servers are just stringing together third party services, minus like a very small core of business logic, I think, in most cases. Obviously there's outliers, but that's what I think. Yeah. But anyway, that's what I've been thinking about is functions and trying to not like just buy into the hype of them, but just thinking about like, okay, how, if I were trying to build DK, could I do it with this? Or like DK's MVP, could I do it with this? Could I do it with Next? Could I do it without this other dedicated thing? And I think I probably could, because most of the Phoenix business or the Elixir business logic was data transforming and putting it back into the database, or scheduling a job and putting it into Redis, which can like, that can be anything. You could have really, at the end of the day, PG is your app, Postgres is your app, and you can connect whatever to it, and you could have whatever run your jobs and whatever build the UI. And
now we're getting to the Graphile territory again, right?
Not necessarily. Yeah. I mean, you could do that, but what I'm saying is that like it doesn't necessarily, and I'm not advocating for microservices, but basically everything doesn't necessarily have to be under the same umbrella, the same language, the same tool chain, the same everything. What I'm saying is, like, again, under the idea of like MVP and proving that your thing has legs before like codifying everything into like a rigid package that you just, it becomes very expensive to change. So I don't know. There's arguments against it too, but that's just what I've been thinking about.
I feel lately like I'm happy to talk with you about it. I think it's interesting. Obviously you're immersed in it. I'm kind of burned out thinking about web stacks right now.
Sure.
Try and implement the same thing with new technology X's. Really not productive and energy draining for me. So
yeah,
I've just been kind of searching for some other creative outlets for my software development projects for the future, because it's just a lot right now for me.
We're definitely on different ends of the cycle right now, and it's because I'm not doing product work for myself at all.
Yeah, right.
I'm playing a lot of Call of Duty on the outside of work.
That's good. What's your KD up to?
1.5.
You got it. Wasn't that your goal?
Actually, it might be higher. Where's my phone?
Was your goal 1.5 or 2?
1.5.
Well, good, man. Are there like seasons or whatever?
Yeah, the new one started today.
Rocket League season just started. I got to get on that.
Well, let me look. So they have this. This is one of the reasons why I play this. But there's like COD Tracker, which has as much like more stats than you ever need about yourself.
I think Noah normally does that.
Oh, so it's 1.6.
Damn.
Yeah, so over the last week I have 295, and this is Battle Royale, not like the small map. So, it's 295 kills and 184 deaths.
That's impressive.
They have this really cool chart though that I kind of wanted to make my personal site because the API is open, but it runs from dated. I'll try to put a screenshot of this in the chat or the show notes for chat, but it's like a daily KD map, and so blue is K and red is D, and so you can see by day your like the visual representation on a line graph of your KD over time.
Dude, this is wild. So your webcam must not have a IR filter, because I can see the Face ID sensor going crazy on the webcam.
Yeah,
hold it up again.
Oh yeah, that's cool.
You're lasering us. Pew, pew, pew.
That's what it looks like when someone in the game is looking at you and they have a laser on their gun. It's like the green laser on the eyeball. You're like,
it's the last thing you see.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, there's like stats for days in this thing. That's why, I don't know. I just look at the stats. Really, I play it so I can look at the stats over time.
As long as the stats are green.
Right. Oh, Kid Queb is playing. He started playing 12 minutes ago.
You better go catch up.
I won't say his KD out loud.
Oh.
Shots fired.
Literally.
I should probably get going. But sound off on Twitter. We would love to hear if Google Sheets is or is not a database. So far, we have conflicting statements happening in the chat.
What if you took JSON and you put it in a Google Sheets column? Like you could put JSON in a Google Doc, like because Google Drive, the storage limits on that are pretty high, so you could get a lot of data in there. You can let us know on Twitter, DNC Cast. Sean is Sean Washbutt, and I'm Shrockwell.
If you're interested, everything we talked about today is going to be in the show notes at dnc.show.
And we're always streaming every week, Thursday night, 6 Pacific, 9 Eastern, twitch.tv/dnccast. Come on by. We got a bunch of new people in the chat this week. Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming by. And you should join them.
And on top of all of that, we also have a Discord. So if you just want to chat with other people, if you want to scheme in a hardware channel about if you could actually convert printed output to JSON for an API, you could probably talk about that in the hardware channel. In fact, we should probably post about it and just let them go. I bet Paul would build it over the weekend, right?
Oh, yeah, no question.
But if you're interested in getting in on that printer to JSON API product we're about to be launching, there's going to be an invite in the show notes. So check the bottom of the show notes. There'll be an invite to Discord. Click on it and you'll be in.
Did you see the dumpster fire stream that Hey.com set up a few weeks ago?
I did not.
So what they did was they set up, just like you said, they set up a printer on a webcam, and you could send an email to a certain Hey.com address, and it would print out the email, and then it would show it on the webcam, and then the email would ride a conveyor belt into a literal dumpster that was on fire.
Was Max Temkin involved in that?
I don't know who that is.
Really? Cards Against Humanity, Max Temkin?
Oh, it does sound like one of those stunts for sure.
Right, because they put a webcam up of a crane just digging a hole in the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, if you're into other design and development adjacent podcasts, head on over to spec.fm and check them out.
Mongo adjacent podcasts.
Yeah, Mongo adjacent. Here's what we do. We get a stack of empty disks, and every write request burns it to a CD.
Oh, like write only?
Yes.
CDRs? I was thinking we could do like a floppy disk array, you know, like a RAID array of 3.25-inch floppies.
Basically, the API is a Rolodex of floppy disks. And when you make a request to the endpoint, it flips to the proper disk, inserts the disk, reads the data, and returns it as JSON.
Oh, like one of those like stereo, like a one of those old CD changers?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. What we could do is we could develop like a driver interface for each of these things that just can layer on itself, basically DB middleware, right? And then we can implement any of these. It's just a common interface. Might be fun.
What do you think the latency would be on a carrier pigeon based API?
It's been done. There's an RFC for it. I'm not even joking.
What?
Yeah.
This is that's wild. I'm running out of ideas here. I think I just got all of my like physical media like API ideas out.
Posted a link into the chat. RFC 1149, a standard for the transmission of IP datagrams on avian carriers.
Avian IP over avian carrier.
Published April 1st, 1990.
I mean, I bet we could raise some money.
I love that there's two RFCs updating it. There's one updating it for IPv6. We updated it for IPv6 in 2011. What's this other one? Oh, IP over avian carriers with quality of service. There's a freaking ass yard of a bird flying around. Oh, this is great.
It's wild. I really enjoy when people drop stuff on me like that, like the coffee one, the API status code.
Classic. All right, we should let you go.
All right.
Talk to you later, man.
All right. Yeah, have a good night, everybody.